This is What's It Like with Dr. Ken Tangen.
Hi, I'm Ken Tangen. This is episode 91 of What's It Like. My guest is Lynn Lohr. Somewhere in California?
Northern California, 20 miles south of San Francisco, right by the Pacific Ocean.
Oh, how nice. Did you grow up in that area?
No, I grew up in New York.
Oh, you're a long way from home.
Well, I went to college in Southern California, and then I went back east for graduate school, and then I moved here in 1985 at the invitation of John Weakland, who was one of the three founders of MRI, the Mental Research Institute. They were among the pioneers in re-strategic family therapy back in the 60s and 70s and 80s.
So did you come from a large family?
No, a small family. I have one sister.
Oh. So when you were growing up, who had the biggest influence on your life?
My ice skating teacher.
Hmm.
I started skating as a kid and had this wonderful skating coach who was British and captivating and just wonderful. And I stuck with it, so I skated several times a week during the school year and in intensive training camps in the summer. And after a number of years, she decided to send a few of her, not necessarily best skaters, but those with the best behavior so she wouldn't be embarrassed, back to train with her coach in England. So I spent my high school summers training in England with the European competitors. And it was just a wonderful international community. Skating opened all kinds of doors for me that way, and it meant when I was going to college and graduate school that I could take classes that interested me without being terribly goal-oriented because I could always teach skating and pay my expenses that way. So I never took out student loans. I taught skating 20, 30 hours a week, and I took classes. And I've always taught skating and after I became a social worker and I was working with inner city at-risk kids primarily, I started also developing recreational therapy programs, both for the kids with impulse control problems and also kids with special needs. So I've been coaching kids with autism, cerebral palsy, other developmental delays, as well as just impulsive and overly energetic kids.
So were you Olympic bound at some point?
I wasn't. I didn't have the talent, but I trained with all the Olympic-bound people. John Curry was a close friend of mine. He won the Olympics in 1976.
So how did it feel to be a part of a group, but to feel like you weren't the best in the group?
Well, I started skating as physical therapy because I was slow, so that was my whole life. It was hardly new.
So what was your major challenge as a child?
The physical delays and weaknesses and some learning disabilities.
Mm-hmm.
So I have very poor muscle tone, minimal strength, terrible coordination. And all the years of really serious hard work I did, I made about 3 to 4 years of progress in 12 years of much harder work than most people put in.
Hmm.
So people whizzed by me. It was just, you could get demoralized or you could cope.
Mm-hmm. And coping was your alternative.
Oh, it seemed the better of the two choices.
Yes, it is. But people don't always choose the best of their choices.
No, but again, what comes with this is also very limited energy. And the people who seem to fight it had a lot more energy than I did.
Mm-hmm.
And your psychology students may not find this terribly helpful, but I think one of the keys to mental health is laziness, because I don't really have the energy to have big flamboyant problems and act out a lot and fritter away energy. If I'm going to get up and do something, I'd really like it to pay off.
What was school like for you?
Very difficult and very unpleasant.
Mm-hmm.
All the way through.
And yet you made it through a lot of years.
Yes, well, again, there was a certain lack of direction in a fair amount of that.
You didn't always want to be a social worker?
It wasn't that I didn't always want to be a social worker. I went through high school in a community, a suburb of New York, where everybody went to college. So it wasn't a question of whether I would go. It was just, could I get through with good enough grades that I could get into a reasonably good college? And the answer was no, not near home, but I went to Scripps, which is a small women's college on the West Coast, part of a cluster modeled on the Oxford and Cambridge plans with several small colleges affiliated under one larger umbrella. So you get the advantages of a big university as well as the advantages of a very small home college. And that was a really good choice. I got in with relatively poor grades because they wanted a diverse student body. And for whatever reasons, they had very few students from the Northeast applying that year, so that helped me get in. But when I got there, it really was the right choice because they had very, very small classes, and they had requirements for things that I would have done badly on tests where you have to memorize material. But if you wanted to propose doing something instead, as long as it was harder than what you were trying to get out of, it was pretty easy to do that. So they had us write constantly, and if you therefore want to write a paper instead of taking an exam, you could do that. So I became a reasonably capable writer, the constant writing that I did, and I also managed to get out of taking the test, which I surely would have done very poorly on. So as a result, when I applied to graduate school, I looked like a much better, more enterprising student than I really was. I was compensating for poor memory and some learning disabilities, which made test taking very difficult for me. And if you're writing a paper, you don't have to memorize anything. You just have to be able to find the notes. And you need to be able to have an opinion and document it reasonably well. And being opinionated was not one of my shortcomings. So it worked out very well. And as a result, I then didn't have much difficulty getting into graduate school, where they're not interested in superficial survey courses and having you memorize a lot of facts that you would spit back. It was much more that very hyper-specialized stuff. And so that was fine. And by then, my interest in the therapeutic skating programs was very clear. And it just happened that at that point, I was getting my doctorate at Duke, and Greensboro, North Carolina opened a new ice rink, and they needed a coach. And they didn't have any existing programs, so they were willing to give me a couple hours of ice weekday mornings when they couldn't do anything else with it. And I set up programs for several of the... there was a residential school for teenagers with developmental disabilities. There was a program for... There was a wonderful orthopedic school, children mostly with cerebral palsy. And then there was an enormous... kindergarten, it was probably kindergarten through second grade, for very young, newly diagnosed kids with all sorts of developmental issues. And so I had the ice, I think it was Tuesdays and Thursdays, for 3 hours at a clip to run these kids through. So they all got to come frequently enough that they made a lot of progress. And I was working with the occupational and physical therapists, and we were getting fabulous stuff out of the kids. They overcame fears. They became much more confident in their movement. And it carried over to walking and walking in the rain and all kinds of other things. So it was, I knew I had found my niche with that. It's not a niche that pays your rent, though. So I've always done that kind of as a sideline. But what I really think I'm very good at and better at than what I get paid for, which is a little bit more typical.
When you were growing up and having such difficulties with traditional school, did you discover anything, any ways of coping that you think others... that would be helpful to others?
Find somebody who takes an interest in you. In other words, go shopping for a mentor and somebody who will give you a way through. My skating coach was wonderful. And the discipline that you learn in skating gives you a disciplined way of approaching any other challenge. So it was ideal for me. It also gave me a skill that made me readily employable. And what I try to do now when I work with at-risk youth is give them a learn-by-doing experience. I think they spend far too much time sitting in chairs, and they're not better or more enthusiastic students than I was, and it didn't work for me, although I probably had a much better academic background and family educational background to draw on. So I try to find ways for them to get experiences that want them to do well and excel because they see how they could and that they could make a difference. And then they're quite willing to learn some of the skills they need to make that work. So the other thing I've done, and the reason Karen Pryor suggested you talk with me, in addition to the therapeutic skating, is I work with animal shelters. And I bring that risk youth in, and we teach them the basic skills to shape behaviors with positive reinforcement, and we train the animals to make them more adoptable.
Hmm.
And so the kids see that they can easily master a skill that is fun, is readily beneficial, and opens up worlds of opportunity for the animals. So the students learn both how to analyze basic behaviors, how to teach with positive reinforcement, and how to plan ahead for the future of the animal. And gradually that backs into planning ahead for themselves, something they wouldn't otherwise have been terribly interested in.
Mm-hmm.
And in addition, they get to shadow some of the other people who work in the animal shelter. So we've got some animal control officers who are willing to talk to them about their work, let them occasionally go out with them in the field, and help them as they're writing case notes and things like that. So they see the importance of paying attention to detail, making objective assessments of risk, pulling it together, writing coherent reports. We have a couple of wonderful veterinarians. And so what we did last year with kids who particularly had shown us, shall we say, a certain lack of enthusiasm for algebra and asked compelling questions about how would they ever use this and what was the point of it. So what the veterinarian did is she took them through the shelter and she introduced them to a bunch of the animals and explained what was wrong with them, what medication she had prescribed. And then we had them figure out the dose. So the animals are weighed on a scale in pounds. The medications are given in milligram of drug per kilogram of body weight. So they had to convert the animal's weight from pounds to kilograms and then figure out the correct dosage based on the instructions, whether it was 1, 2, 3, or 4 times a day. And then they had to look at the amount of medication per pill and figure out how many pills or what fraction of a pill. And then they have to write instructions. Let's say the animal got adopted and had to take home a week's worth of medication. They would have to calculate that and write the instructions. And since most of the kids I work with, English is not their first language, and their parents tend not to speak much English, we had them write the instructions in both languages. And then the animal shelter was left with templates to use.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah, so it's fabulous.
Yeah, good for everybody.
Then the math and the science teachers have something to work on and some much more motivated students to work with because
mm-hmm.
they see the importance of this. And the fact is, for most animal welfare programs, they have plenty of entry-level jobs where you just need a high school education. And because they are open more than 40 hours a week, they're looking for people who would work peculiar hours. And so they're happy to plan it around a student going to a community college or college, maybe part-time. So you could schedule to take 2 classes at the community college, working towards the law enforcement degree, thinking you might become an animal control officer, or the veterinary technician program, which is analogous to the nursing program, but a little bit more rigorous. Or just if you wanted to take psychology and then work in adoptions and customer relations, or some people who want to get degrees in business.
Mm-hmm.
There are plenty of ways they can work in the shelters, and they can do that taking as many classes as they can handle and working as many hours as they need in order to pay their bills. So it's a way to do it where they don't have to take on student debt, and they can immediately put into practice whatever they're learning in the classroom. And that's been quite a motivating approach for many people. It's also been much more acceptable to many of the immigrant families who came here hoping their children would learn English and succeed, but they're worried about how much the kids will acculturate, and they fear that too much acculturation will lead to moving away, distancing themselves psychologically, emotionally, culturally from the family, and losing the primary language so that they wouldn't be able to talk together easily. With this kind of hybrid program, it actually anchors them in the community more because they become the bilingual and bicultural interpreter when their neighbors come in, either to adopt an animal or to license it or something like that.
Mm-hmm. So what exactly do you do?
Many people ask. I am a licensed clinical social worker, And that is my primary profession. I was a child protective services worker for a number of years, and I investigated cases of child abuse and neglect. I also teamed up with my counterparts in animal control, and we designed a number of programs to train animal cruelty investigators, child protective services workers, and also adult protective services workers in identifying and cross-reporting, so that if an emergency responder goes out, the conditions that would jeopardize a frail elder, a vulnerable child, or the family pet would all be obvious to all possible responders, and they would know how to take action and cross-report. And I worked on legislation in California that added the state humane and the animal control officers to the mandated reporters of child and elder abuse. And we were the first to get those two pieces in place, but by now many, many states have that. So I do a fair amount of training in cross-reporting.
Mm-hmm. A mandated reporter is someone who is required by law to, if they suspect child abuse or elder abuse, to report it to the local
county. Mm-hmm. And depending on the jurisdiction, they route the calls. Most places now have a hotline, so you call that hotline and they route it. But some places that are a little bit less automated have all kinds of separate numbers. But the laws are state-level laws, but the enforcement is at the county level.
What's the best thing about your job?
Well, the best thing about what I do is that I do several things. And so if either because of politics or funding, or sometimes just my getting fed up, I can always move to one of the others. So I've got the skating with the special needs kids, and I've got the work with the animal shelters and the at-risk youth pretty much as constants. But they turn on and off depending on the school year and the seasonality of the rink where I coach. So I do more. I'm an instructor with UC Davis Extension, where they provide in-service training for child protective services workers throughout the state. And that's nice because I get to meet my colleagues who are still on the front line doing the cruelty investigations, but it also gives me a feel for how things are going. And with the economic downturn, things are not going very well. So if I were in a 40-hour traditional job still at either a nonprofit or a county agency, I would be much more demoralized.
Mm.
But assuming your audience is younger, it's very, very good to get your first couple of years of that kind of experience. You will get more cases in less time, and that breadth gives you perspective that you can't get any other way. And I know with some of my colleagues who went directly from graduate school into counseling positions as opposed to the CPS work that I did, they had maybe 20 cases their first year, and I had 300. So getting 1,000 cases really does teach you something that getting 60 cases wouldn't.
Mm-hmm.
And you also learn how the system works, and you then see people who get terribly upset thinking that they have an unresponsive worker when what they're asking is illegal, or the system just can't do it. So to start off with a degree that lets you learn something well will ground you, and then after that you can go off in all kinds of creative directions with that bedrock of experience in a much more realistic lay of the land.
Let me turn your question around. What's the worst thing about your job?
For me it's not a problem, but the worst thing I think objectively is I don't earn much.
Mm-hmm.
And the other piece of advice I think I would have for your listeners is get really good at living on very little money. It gives you freedom. I'm not good with big money. I'm not good at grants. I have no skills like that. But I'm very good at doing a lot with very little. And that's more compatible with the poor families that I work with in the inner cities. A lot of them live in homeless shelters or are camped out in Golden Gate Park or something like that. If I needed a budget and resources to make a difference, I wouldn't be able to work with them, and they wouldn't have any tolerance for me. So that I could do something with pennies and Band-Aids is useful, and that my budget doesn't really allow for more than that isn't a problem. So what I found that I did is I learned to live on much, much, much less the minute I left my more middle-class parents' home. And when I started earning money coaching skating, no matter how little I earned, I always put at least 20% of it in a savings account. And that way, when something unexpected happened, I had the money to cover it. And so I've had a sense of freedom to pick and choose what I do and where I go, because I had a financial cushion and I didn't have big spending habits.
Mm-hmm. What type of person would be good at your job?
It depends how you define my job. Most social workers are very caring, compassionate people, and they tend to be very hard workers. I think a certain amount of greater experience with money and that kind of planning would probably make them more effective, because I've seen people really care and waste an incredible amount of time and effort on things that were financially not terribly practical. I think one of the most useful courses I ever took was a semester of accounting at the community college, where I got really good at math. And I don't mean fancy math, but I mean just managing a budget and living within it. And each year I would try to find a way of saving a couple more pennies. And I learned to do my own taxes. And I don't spend much. I don't like to shop. I don't wear jewelry or makeup. So I'm kind of low maintenance. And that way I can earn very little money and it still works out. So I'm not sure that that's the growing academic message, but it has given me the freedom to do. I think the best work that I've done has been unpaid, and I wouldn't be able to spend, and I've always spent at least a quarter of my time not getting paid for stuff. The work I do with the kids with special needs and the ice skating programs, the rink donates the time, I donate my time. The families pay a nominal fee to cover incidental expenses, and frequently they don't. And it's a pleasure, it's wonderful. Having a child with special needs is incredibly expensive. The families are just delighted that they have a program that costs them just a couple dollars a week and the whole family participates. So it's a way of doing something really valuable where money isn't an obstacle. And the programs at the animal shelters also, there's no money for that. So the families who come, we all kick in time, we all kick in supplies. If we can get a little bit of stuff donated, that's great. I generally pay for the treats for the animals out of my pocket because it's just easier than coming up with a way to find some funding, and they don't need that much. So if you can do it for very little money, you can do a lot. And programs that have had funding cuts or are perennially short-staffed and underfunded, if you come in as a volunteer and you're fingerprinted and responsible and you're not going to create havoc and you will do a little good and it won't cost them anything, it's a much easier way to do it. Although many people don't share my disinclination to earn money. One of my friends had said I had really mastered the art of downward mobility.
That's a skill.
Yes, well, and he has too, actually. He was my classics professor in college. I took Greek and Latin and all kinds of interesting classes from him. And then he got fed up with advanced education and started working in residential treatment programs for adjudicated youth. So his salary went down a fair amount. And then he went from there to inner city schools in the Bronx. So I think together we've managed to master the art of downward mobility.
Sounds like it.
So he was my mentor in many things beyond Greek and Latin.
If one wanted to, how would they get a job like yours?
You would start off by getting a master's degree in social work and then getting a couple years' experience in a county agency or a mental health program that served the county clients. And you would get a good sense of the lay of the land, what the system can and can't do. And with such a broad array of clients, you'd get a feel for where you did the best. And a lot of that is simply what age groups, what problems are you good at, and which ones really drive you nuts. That gets us back to 1,000 cases in a few years, and then you'll have a pretty good sense where you can make a difference and what interests you. And my other suggestion is get good at a couple of things. So when the financial wind changes, you can switch directions rather easily. So do one more than the other, but always keep a toe in at least two ponds.
Mm-hmm. If there is such a thing, what's a typical day like for you?
Well, the typical part is I share furniture with a very large Great Dane mix. And so she, I wouldn't say the square footage of the furniture isn't divided fairly. If you could include the corners, I probably do have access to half, but she starts in the middle and radiates out diagonally.
First come, first serve?
Yeah, she runs by me on the stairs going up and then lands as the hypotenuse. So I kind of work my way around her. But at the beginning of the first crack of dawn, with the first chirp of the bird, she's up wanting to go out. So my typical day starts much earlier than I would like it to, with her shoving me out of bed. But once we get going, it is nice to live so near the ocean. So she gets a walk on the ocean every morning. We walk for about an hour as the sun comes up. So as much as I wish I could sleep in for another half hour, we do have, it feels like the entire Pacific Coast to ourselves. And I have one or two neighbors with dogs that are friends. So we walk either on the hills or on the coast. And the dogs have a nice run, and then we come back and we have a leisurely breakfast. And then it changes from day to day, whether I'm going to do some training or I have some high school kids to meet at the animal shelter or if I'm going to the ice rink to work with autistic kids. And about twice a month, I have a trip out of town to go teach one of the county agencies through UC Davis.
Then everybody has to give themselves motivation occasionally. How do you give yourself a kick in the pants?
Well, all the ice skating training has helped with that. When I was younger and I had a job that had a lot of stuff I didn't like in it, it really was just a question of following the rules and doing the schedule. I didn't assume I would like everything. And I did need to pay the bills, and I didn't like getting attention for bad behavior. So I'm pretty well behaved, and I show up on time, and I do the work. And the arrangements I tended to work out with whoever I was working for was, as long as I do a better-than-average job 40 hours a week, if there's any extra time, I get to pursue an extra interest. And so that arrangement worked well for me, and it worked well for them, because I think they saw with my verbal skills that I could have been quite a problem if they had not worked out such a deal. What I did when I started in Child Protective Services doing emergency response, which I really liked and I was good at, and they transfer people as they need to fill slots, and I got transferred to the long-term placement caseload, which is kids for whom things have gone badly. They didn't get to go home. They didn't get adopted by a relative or their foster parent, and so they will be system kids, presumably, till they emancipate. And a lot of these kids had all kinds of developmental delays that nobody had ever paid much attention to. So that was the deal I made with the county, is that I would take this, I was involuntarily rotated into long-term placement, which is where nobody ever wanted to go, so they rotated by picking names out of a hat, and mine was picked. But I did know something about the special needs. I didn't know how that system worked in California. This was just about 2 years after I had moved here. So I said I would go, I would do my best, but I wouldn't complain about it if they would let me address the special needs. Well, they always should have been addressed, so I was really fixing a gap. But in the process, I learned how the special needs system didn't work for kids who were also getting services for child protection. In fact, they're mutually exclusive systems. And what we did by filing a petition to protect the child from abuse and neglect was take over care of that child in a system that didn't have services for kids with special needs. So by protecting the child, we pretty much guaranteed they would get no services for their developmental delays.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a serious problem. And if you have considerable developmental delays, I'm not sure that was the better choice. And it shouldn't have been the choice. You should have been able to take the developmental services with you. Well, so the kids who had been in the system for years, if they had ever had a developmental exam, it was 3, 5, 10 years out of date. So I went in and I got everything dusted off and updated, and I turned up at all the IEPs, and I got every child some kind of recreational therapy, and I mean, it was worth it. But then the problem was, when I got rotated out of that, whoever came in next was just a placeholder, and 2 years later, there wasn't a trace of what I had done. And that's the nature of the beast. So I think when people are younger, they kind of need to realize that's how it goes, and find small ways to make small differences that might last, at least for those people. Mm-hmm. If you can make a tiny difference in the system, and I think where I did was the legislation with the mandated reporting. Not that the human services people have been quick on this, but animal control is out seeing people at risk exactly the same way the animals are. And frequently, animal control is the first agency called because it's easier for people to pick up the phone and say, my neighbor's dog is outside howling, than to call CPS and say, my neighbor's beating his kid with a belt.
Mm-hmm.
And the result is that legislation has made a difference, and it has empowered a lot of very, very good workers in animal welfare to be emboldened and also protected with immunity, because when you're required to report, you're also given immunity from retaliation. So that has been really powerful. And as I got older, I was able to pursue the things that interested me more and stop working for other agencies, and that was liberating, but certainly cut my income in half.
Hmm. When you have to soothe yourself, how do you calm yourself down?
I'm actually very lazy, so that's not a problem. Truly, if Netflix had existed when I was in graduate school, I would never have finished. I think Netflix and writing a dissertation are completely incompatible.
I suspect.
No, I'm from New York, so I talk quickly, and I'm just kind of animated in talking. But there's a bedrock of it'd be easier to have a cup of coffee and a cookie and then take a nap. So it's just never been a problem.
Mm-hmm. Is there an event in your life that has challenged you to the core?
A couple, and all on the same theme. I think the first one that was really significant for me, my father's sister was diagnosed with breast cancer when I was in high school. And I had about a month in between skating in the summer and when my classes started my first year in graduate school. And so I spent them helping her out. And it was just, she actually died about 2 weeks after I started graduate school classes. So she had a studio apartment on Long Island Sound, and the two of us stayed there, and her kids had been doing the bulk of the care, so I was able to give them a break, and they were exhausted. And she and I got very close, and I found out that I was very good, somewhat to my surprise, at helping people who were pretty close to death. And since then, through unfortunate circumstances with a couple of friends who've had one of my closest friends, her son died of cancer a few years ago, and I did the medical social work for her. And a couple of people who were very close to me, when they got terminal diagnoses, I came in and did what I could. And I'm good at it. It's very meaningful, and it makes everything else look pretty trivial.
Mm-hmm. Is there an idea or a principle that has helped you through your challenges?
That's hard to answer. I'm not religious. I'm a vegan. I try to do a little good and very little harm. But it's not in a religious or spiritual way.
If you were giving a commencement address for high school or college, giving your best advice, what would you say?
Well, first of all, I think it's most unlikely that I will ever be asked to do such a thing. So this is my once-in-a-lifetime opportunity.
That's why I give you the chance.
Yes, but I just heard a bit of the ones that Barack Obama and Madeleine Albright did, and I just started reading Prague Winters, and I read Madam Secretary a while back, and I was very impressed with Madeleine Albright. But I don't have any long-lasting or profound thing to say. I don't think most people graduating from college need or particularly want that kind of advice, that there's trite obviousness. This is the beginning of the rest of your life. You've got a degree. It will open doors. Now go change the world. I think the only advice, I have two pieces of advice, and one is very practical. Be very careful with your finances so you don't dig yourself into a hole you can't get out of. And the other is find something that you're good at and that you enjoy doing and that you can turn into something you would do to give others a hand. Whether it's the animal-assisted and recreational therapy work that I do, which I do without income, or if you find something that you like as a hobby, find a way to turn it into some sort of skill where you could work with some other people and introduce them to what you're good at and earn enough money that you can pay your way and have the freedom to do what you want on your own time without income being a decisive factor.
Sounds like a good speech to me.
Oh, well, very good. And my one and only opportunity.
I want to thank Lynn Lohr for joining me today. Thanks, Lynn. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. It was fun to talk.
If you'd like to leave a comment, ask a question, or get more info, go to whatsitlike.info.